And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. When she lost her job at the alt-weekly Philadelphia City Paper, when it closed, Emily Gindelsberger took a job with Amazon, and then with a call center, and then with McDonald's. Her experience in some of the nation's low-wage positions is the basis of her new book, On the Clock: What Low-Wage Work Did to Me and How It Drives America Insane. And joining Cincinnati Edition to talk about that experience is the author and journalist, Emily Gindelsberger. She joins us on Skype. Hi, Emily. Thanks for being here.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And we want to hear from you, too. If you've got some experience in some of these low-wage opportunities, go ahead and give us a call and share those experiences. 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'll look for your comments and your tweets and try to get some of those into the show as well. So, Emily, as I said there, you've got a background in journalism, and I read that your first sort of foray into this type of work that you document in this book was actually with Uber, which isn't necessarily part of the book, but you had seen while you were still working as a reporter that Uber drivers may have been told that they could earn up to like $90,000 a year. So you became a driver to check out the veracity of that possibility. So I wanted to start there because ride sharing is a favorite topic of this show. Can you just tell us a little bit about what happened in that experience?
So yeah, that was when it was back in 2015 when Uber had just first come into, or UberX rather, the unlicensed version had come into Philadelphia, and it was, you know, a big deal. It was all over the news all the time. And one of the things I saw quoted, like specifically from the company, was their line that I believe it was their median driver made 90 grand a year. And that seemed to be really obviously not true to me. But I did not. That's the thing. They make it very hard to actually calculate, to keep track of that sort of thing, because a lot of drivers I found don't actually really keep track of their expenses, maybe gas, but not things like the depreciation on your car, how much more often you're having to repair your car, like the fact that you're going to put $200,000 or 200,000 miles on your car in like 2 years. So because I wasn't able to get Uber to give me the information that I was looking for, and because I wasn't able to get it accurately any other way, I went and signed up myself so I would be sure that my data was clean. And I worked for a couple months. And yeah, I mean, honestly, that article went kind of viral because I think it was the first time anybody had actually checked on those numbers for real. And that's basically the reason that I got to do this book. I think people, not just me, but, you know, editors saw that there was kind of a really big audience for just talking real talk about like what these jobs actually are and sort of not buying into the very tech positive viewpoint that I think was kind of prevalent in 2015.
And you did not make $90,000, or you were not on pace to make that.
No, I made usually between $9 and $10 an hour.
And I thought it was worth bringing up because you do in the book talk about working at Convergys, a call center in North Carolina. We know Convergys well here. Call centers are located here as well in the Cincinnati and Northern Kentucky area. And you sort of describe
headquartered there, right?
Exactly. And you have a sort of similar experience that we'll get into a little later, I suppose. But you know, you've got the managers talking about how much you could make if you do this, this, and this while you're there making the lower wage. But let's start with Amazon, because that was the first place that you decided to work. And you went into this through the typical interview process, and you even used your real name and your work history as a journalist. And I just thought it was really curious that they didn't see any red flags in that history when it came to bringing you on board.
I mean, to be honest, out of work journalists, not that rare these days, you know?
And
lots of people have lost their jobs. Lots of people are, you know, going to a place where, like for me, it was like half interest, but also half desperation. Like I had just lost my job. It was the sort of the third newspaper that had sort of closed out from under me. And I just could not deal with you know, my heart breaking again for, right away. So I decided to do this project sort of a little bit out of my mind, but I was just like, yeah, whatever. All right, I'm going, I'm just going to like leave town, like with a couple weeks notice and go do this. And if nothing else, I will make a couple grand. And that was, you know, for that first one, I hadn't sold the book. Like I had no contract. I just was like, well, I've always wanted to do this. I've always wanted to see what it's like. And if something comes out of it, good. If not, at least I'll have, you know, some money.
And you really upended your life to do this because you did not take an Amazon job in Philadelphia. You came not far from here. You ended up in southern Indiana across from Louisville. And you were working at Amazon at Christmas time, which is a very busy season for them. And part of your training was learning this point system where you basically have like six strikes before they fire you, and you get strikes for like being late or not showing up. And you write about the experience of other employees. I want to read a quick quote. Quote, "But over the next month, I will be legitimately shocked at how many of my coworkers see Amazon's small allotment of unpaid time off, or UPT, as generous." So on top of these low wages, Emily, and some of the small benefits that are offered, why do you think some of those other employees that you encountered there feel gratitude for a job that may not be worthy of such?
Well, for Amazon in particular, I can see why, like I talked to plenty of people and I do know why they liked it, which is like, it is a very physically difficult job. But, you know, at the time it was paying, like I was getting $10.50 an hour. And so were a lot of people. There weren't many people making over $13 an hour in the sort of my job position, no matter how long they'd been there. But what I wanted to sort of address is the way that words like generous or like good benefits or stressful, good job, bad job, like all of those phrases have gotten these completely different definitions, have developed for the upper class and the lower class. And so when you just talk to people who work at an Amazon warehouse, and if you don't, you know, do it yourself and examine the benefits package yourself, you know, everything's relative. They would, a lot of people would say, yeah, the benefits are pretty good, even if the benefits are like kind of laughable to people who actually have paid vacation time or paid sick time. The idea that like, oh, you can take some time off if you're sick without getting fired, sort of up to a point. Like that is, I think to me, like if somebody at a newspaper had tried to sell me on that as like a decent benefit, like I would have laughed in his face. And I'm sure that would probably be the case for you as well. Like those, the idea of good benefits means something completely different to me and you and people that work at Amazon or McDonald's. Like, for example, just the solidity of the schedule and the regularity of the schedule at Amazon was seen as a really big benefit, because one of the sort of under-acknowledged problems in the American workforce is that so many retail and fast food jobs, you can't really predict what your schedule is going to be like with any sort of certainty. Your schedule, your hours are different week to week. You may not get the full number of hours that you need to pay your rent. Like it's always changing. And a lot of people saw at least Amazon, you knew when you were going to be working. At least, like if you weren't called in for mandatory overtime, which they could do on a day's notice.
And if you didn't respond, you could get one of those points.
Oh yeah, like it's like any other workday. You can't say no. That's why they call it mandatory overtime. You know.
One of your observations from Amazon that can probably be applied to many workplaces across the country is this quote. "This is one of those weird quirks of the U.S. employment market. If a full-time employee is injured in the course of doing her job, she's eligible for workers' compensation, government-mandated employer coverage of medical costs and money to make up for injury-related lost wages. But freelancers, independent contractors, and seasonal or temp workers, like all of us here for orientation at Amazon, are just out of luck. We have a personal responsibility not to injure ourselves by overworking." And that's something else that you do throughout this book, is you're not just documenting your experience working for McDonald's or Convergys or Amazon. You do offer some analysis of U.S. labor policy and just employment in America in general. And I'm wondering what you think keeps a situation like that alive in U.S. labor law.
I think it's just that a lot of people who have gotten their way into power are just really into, like, you know, Friedman and Hayek, and to a degree like Ayn Rand. They just have a different idea of how the world works than other people. And I think then, you know, most people on the ground, like, for example, sort of the center of this ideology of, like, all right, we're going to maximize flexibility for corporations while, like, incidentally minimizing flexibility for workers. And, you know, flexibility for companies means that people, like, they can make a lot more money. But, you know, since the 1970s, workers have not been getting any sort of piece of, like, they haven't been getting cut in on, like, the crazy increases in productivity that have been going on since the 1970s. Like, productivity has been going up and up and up and up, and wages have been staying flat. So, and there's this, yeah, sorry, say it again.
No, please, go on.
Oh, yeah. So there's just this sort of fundamental idea of trickle-down economics, like sort of neoclassical economics, free market stuff, where I think if you're actually on the ground, you see that the world that those things are creating is just really, you know, brutal, and it makes it kind of impossible to have a family life. It makes work really chronically stressful for a lot of low-wage workers, and I think that in part that is kind of that chronic stress is kind of driving us all a little bit nuts, especially low wage workers, because higher wage workers do have stressful jobs without a doubt, just as stressful as working at a call center or a McDonald's. I wouldn't say maybe that much more stressful, to be completely honest, having done, you know, different kinds of very stressful jobs, white collar, blue collar, whatever. But yeah, like people are on the ground, I think it's obvious to them that this is not working right. And they actually have, you know, personal experience. Whereas I think a lot of these people who are into, like, basic neoclassical economics and free market stuff do not actually have any on the ground experience with what kind of world this creates for the non-wealthy. And it's a pretty nasty, unforgiving, stressful world.
So I know you've written a whole book now about your experience working for Amazon, McDonald's, and Convergys. I want a quick summary of what your day was like at Amazon, and we're going to get to that coming up. We're going to continue our conversation about On the Clock, what low-wage work did to me and how it drives America insane. And we'll also be joined by a local official whose county will no longer be awarding tax incentives to big-box warehouse developments. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We're joined today by author Emily Gindelsberger. She's the author of a new book, On the Clock, What Low-Wage Work Did to Me and How It Drives America Insane. It documents her short time as a low-wage earner at Amazon, a call center, Convergys, and at McDonald's. Emily, I know you wrote an entire book about this experience, but I'm hoping in a short amount of time, you could just give our listening audience a brief summary of what a typical day was like for you once you became a full-fledged employee at an Amazon distribution center.
Well, I was never a full-fledged employee because I worked through a temp agency. So I was employed by the temp agency, and a lot of Amazon workers come in through temp agencies. It seemed like about a third in general, start out as temps. And again, That's because of the incredibly high turnover, especially during the Christmas months.
And that's something you wrote about. You note how certain people wear these badges and you sort of get a feel for maybe a hierarchy among the employees.
Yeah, if you had a blue badge, that meant you were a full-time employee. And if you had a white badge, it meant that you were a temp like me. And the temps were generally encouraged to, like, you know, work real crazy hard to, you know, achieve that blue badge. That's the thing. These turnover numbers that they have there are so insane that it's really difficult sometimes to try to figure out, you know, any real numbers about them. The one that I saw was that after peak, which is what they call the holiday season, they hire about 15% of the white badges as blue badges. So you really, that's like getting into brown or something, you know, you gotta try real hard to get it. So yeah, my average day. So the shifts were 6:30 a.m. to 6 p.m. or that was my shift. The other shift is 6:30 p.m. to 6 a.m. So I would wake up at 4 because I was living sort of on the other side of Louisville, and I had a 45-minute commute. And it's always, especially with these sort of jobs where you are given attendance points automatically if you're just, like, you know, a couple minutes late clocking in. So you always try to be there like 15 or 20 minutes before your shift starts, so that if anything goes wrong, you know, you're not going to be marked late. So I'd get up at 4, I'd get ready, I would drive out, get there around, you know, 6:15, wait around until I was allowed to log in, which you can do at 6:30 on the dot, and get your scanner. And so then there's this thing called the mod. There's two in my warehouse, and they're these sort of four-story, like, crazy huge warrens of cardboard shelves that all the items are stored in. And I was a picker, and my warehouse was built in 2014, so that's one of the warehouses where pickers actually walk around these, like, crazy shelving systems and actually go find the items themselves and, you know, put it in their cart. Whereas in newer ones, the, you know, robots bring the shelves to the workers. So it's a stationary job. So anyway, I was walking, I snuck a step counter in, and on my average shift, I was like between 13 and 16 miles per day of walking, which got very painful. So especially the first 2 weeks, it does get a little bit easier after, you know, the first 2 weeks when your body starts adjusting. But the problem with that was once my body started adjusting, I was starting to go out of my mind with just, like, the sheer monotony and isolation of it, because you don't really see that many people, even during peak, where there's, you know, twice as many people wandering around the mod as usual. You still, like, don't really ever get to stop to talk to anybody. Like, you'd see them going by sort of in the distance, you'd see them walking by your aisle, but you never really get to talk or stop or do anything except exactly what the scanner that you're carrying around is telling you to do, which is go find the next item. And go find the next item, incidentally, within, like, the number of seconds that they have allotted for you to go find it. So there's all of these different steps to completing a task. I think there were like 4 to picking one item, and they all involve, each step ends when you scan a barcode or something.
But it is that system that they have in place that has made that company so successful and have their logistics so well executed. But
it does
sound like, you know, the humans are a cog in the wheel there, and you've just got to keep moving.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the thing. All of these companies, like, I think the book sometimes gets, like, misconceived as like an expose of these individual companies, which it is not. It is the thing about these companies that they are just following, you know, the rules. They're just following the incentives and the rules very, very, very well and very, very efficiently. They're not doing anything wrong within the current system that we have.
And you talk about incentives a little bit. You reference them when you write about Louisville's economic development pitch on how they land so many of these warehouse type jobs in that region. And while I want you to stay on the line, Emily, because we're going to talk a little more about the book, I want to bring in Boone County Administrator Jeff Erlewine, who's with us. Hi, Jeff. Thanks for being here.
Good morning.
Let's get his mic ready. Our apologies. Hi, Jeff.
Good morning.
All right. There we go. Awesome. And we brought you in because our friend at the Business Courier, Chris Wetterich, had a recap from this week's Northern Kentucky Chamber of Commerce Eggs and Issues Breakfast, where Boone County Judge Executive Gary Moore joined Kenton County Judge Executive Chris Knockelman and Campbell County Judge Executive Steve Pendry to talk about some regional issues. But the headline that Chris wrote is Boone County is done subsidizing big box distribution facilities. And that is interesting because you've got this big boom going in Boone County. Your economy is admirable. There's a lot of stuff happening out there. It's where the airport is and a lot of associated jobs, including the forthcoming Amazon Air Hub, will be located in your county. But talk a little bit about why this change in policy, how you won't be pursuing incentives for these companies anymore.
Certainly. It's good to be with you this morning. The simple answer is that we determined that economic development incentive policies are not required for us to be able to continue to attract companies that are in the logistics, fulfillment, and distribution industry. And if they're not required, we're not going to provide incentives.
And why are they no longer required? Is it just an embarrassment of riches now? You're just so well positioned that you don't have to butter them up anymore?
No, I wouldn't say that. Basically, the county's able to leverage some of our other assets in terms of our transportation system, the airport, a very low tax environment, other resources that we can bring to bear to really help us compete to continue to attract those companies. Now, certainly there was more that went into that policy than just a conscious decision that the incentives are no longer required. There were some practical reasons.
You know, a lot of these companies, particularly the ones that are locating around the airport, are hyped up by the state, you know, that the state gets involved with some of the Kentucky-based incentives, and that's how a lot of these warehouse jobs arrive. But when you hear experiences like what we're hearing from this author, Emily Gindelsberger, who wrote this book, and you know the experience of some employees, the high turnover rate that they have, is there consideration ever when awarding incentives about the types of jobs that are coming? We hear a lot of hype about 2,000 jobs are coming, but if they're $13 an hour or $15 an hour wage jobs, that's not quite as good as, you know, $60,000 a year jobs, right?
Certainly. And that is one of many considerations that would be on our radar screen. In our case, we've had a period of long sustainable growth in a variety of industry segments. But what we've seen in the last 10 years or so would be a disproportionately high growth level when it relates to distribution, logistics, and fulfillment. And we're looking to really build a sustainable local economy that has diversification to it, variety, that can provide a variety of job types. And certainly that's a factor that we think about when we're talking to companies and when we're providing incentives.
And so are we overselling it a bit in Northern Kentucky when we as a region get excited that Amazon is coming and all these jobs are going to be available, or whichever retail chain, Wayfair, is opening up and there's going to be all these warehouse opportunities, that these aren't necessarily great paying jobs?
I wouldn't say we're overselling it. Again, I think there has to be a conscious awareness that it's not the end all be all. That, again, variety and diversity is important, that there is a finite workforce that is available to fill each segment of the industry, and we want to be careful not to oversaturate job opportunities where you don't have a workforce and a talent pipeline that's there to fill the positions.
And so one of the concerns out of Boone County as it relates to the growth of these warehouses is that there's a lot of infrastructure involved in supporting the buildings themselves, right? And you have to supply water. There has to be sewage out there. Were those factors in determining not incentivizing this growth anymore?
Absolutely, they were. And you're spot on in your remark. These are buildings that are a million, now a million two, a million four square feet, 25, 26 acres under roof. There's a finite amount of building pads and level property that's available to support not just logistics and fulfillment, but advanced manufacturing, other industry types. Once you eat that up, you no longer have sites available. They generate a lot of truck traffic. We've had challenges with truck parking, for example. We've got a task force that's working on that right now. But certainly congestion and traffic, those are things that impact the quality of life for your citizens, and we want to be very careful about that. They generate a lot of stormwater. You have to be careful on how you manage down, the impacts downstream when you've got so much impervious area with parking lots and rooftops. So there are a lot of factors that go into play when you're shaping your specific policies on economic development.
And goodness knows that Northern Kentucky has its problem with containing some of the sanitation and, the sanitation district supports three counties in Northern Kentucky, Boone, Kenton, and Campbell. And people in some parts of the region have struggled to keep their basements dry or their homes above water, literally above water, because heavy rains blow through. And, there's so much pressure on the system. And so in a way, when these companies come, there are some drawbacks because the system has to be extended further. Is that right?
There are, whether you call them a drawback or a challenge, certainly there's work to be done. And in a perfect world, you would deliver just-in-time infrastructure upgrades that was just there to meet the growing demand. But as we know, it doesn't work that way. In a perfect world, you have limitations in terms of resources and funding from state and federal level. So that's something that we're challenged with constantly, is being in a position to fund the infrastructure that's necessary to make our businesses successful and, again, to preserve that quality of life for our taxpayers.
And Emily, you've been listening to our conversation with Boone County Administrator Jeff Earlywine and in your new book, On the Clock. Did you learn anything about the way governments incentivize the type of jobs that you experienced?
Well, I definitely saw a rush to hold up any jobs created as, as sort of equal, that they were all, any job was the same as any other job when it came to job creation. And you see that nationally, in the Obama administration was holding up all of the job gains after the recession. But that was the thing, most of those job gains, it was a huge chunk of jobs got wiped out in the recession, and they were, they were replaced, but they were replaced with crappier jobs. You know what I mean? They were replaced with, temp things, gig things, things with no security, things with no predictability, fast food, retail. They're just jobs that nobody is excited about doing, that have no future to them.
And you also decided to work out after Amazon. You went to work for Convergys. And in the middle of the Great Recession, I was, like you, an unemployed journalist for about a year and got really desperate myself. And I went to interview at Convergys locally just at
a point of
desperation. Yeah. So I was reading this and thinking, oh, this is all so familiar. But the irony for me was I was interviewed for a position where I would have been answering phones to help people understand their health insurance benefits while not receiving health insurance benefits from the company and being paid $9 an hour with 10 years of news experience. And it was so humbling. I did not take the job, so I didn't go as far as you did. But talk a little bit briefly about your experience at that call center in North Carolina working for Convergys, whom we know well in this area.
Yeah, Convergys was pretty rough. I found them to be, whereas I found Amazon to be very sort of sleekly, apex predator. You could tell that they were, they had it together very well in a way that made people feel like robots, but at least it all worked. Convergys was difficult in that it was sort of a whole bunch of different systems all kludged together. And it was just impossible. And it was a different sort of stress, although it came from the same sort of idea that you have to constantly monitor workers for every second they're on the clock if you don't want them to, mess around. At Convergys, the only time that the company was actually getting paid was when the the rep, the call center representative, was logged into the phone system and actually on a call with a customer of, in my case, AT&T. And so they were very, very, very on making sure that you were actually logged into your phone all of the time. So, like, they paid a lot of attention to how much time you spent in the bathroom. There were just all sorts of crazy stories from Convergys and from, you know, a lot of call centers that I was, you know, doing research online beforehand. And there were so many crazy stories about, like, you know, people having to wear a stopwatch around their neck when they go to the bathroom, people having to, like, put in bids based on their performance for when they were able to go to the bathroom. It was just wild. So the stress that came from that one was less, you know, physical and from loneliness like Amazon was. And it was just the stress of being constantly, constantly, constantly monitored and having this, you know, living in this sort of panopticon state where anybody, I mean, you know, when you get, when you call into some way, they say, you know, this call may be monitored for quality assurance. That is because, like, most call center reps, like, have it in their mind that, like, oh yeah, my supervisor could be listening in at any time. And in some ways, like your worst calls, the rumor is that they would get flagged based on, you know, the volume of the person, like whether you said particular words, like there was supposedly some computer program that could pick that up. But it was mostly the stress of just having to put up with people yelling at you all the time, like all day.
All right. Well, I mean, I think we get the general picture, and it's you go into far more detail about it. So I don't want you to give it all away. We'll let people read that book. I want to take a phone call. Let's get Chris on the line. Hi, Chris. What's your question or comment?
Yeah, I was just talking to your screener and told them that the way that you guys are categorizing these jobs, saying that they're undesirable and people don't want them, the retail, fast food, warehouses, those are the kind of jobs that the people in the actual middle of the country rely on for our livelihood. And your position just comes off as completely elitist.
Chris,
well, here's the thing.
Yeah, stay on the line, Chris. Let's hear from Emily on that.
So I hope that you actually read the book, because I do get a lot more into that in the book, even if I can't in you know, interviews like this, in that, like, I do make a point of talking to people that like these jobs or that, you know, appreciate these jobs. And when I was at Amazon, like, I definitely met people that really appreciated these. And although I did not meet anybody at Amazon in particular that I would say really would say they liked retail or fast food, that seemed to be, from the people that I talked to, the least desirable job you could get, although it was, you know, a job. And that's, like, legit. I'm not going to tell people not to take, I'm not going to say that my judgment about what people should expect out of jobs in their area is, like, wrong.
Yeah.
Like, I talked to plenty of people. They know better than I do, for sure. It's just more of, like, what do you do for a living, Chris?
I'm a stalker at Walmart. And no, I don't enjoy it, but guess what? That's what I have to do to pay my bills and do what I got to do.
No, I mean, that's what I'm saying is, like, I'm not saying that you should, like, quit your job in protest or something. What I'm saying is that it's possible. Like, there are actual ways to make it less bad.
And we've got about 15 seconds left. And Chris, I so wish you would have called earlier, because I so would have wished that, and I apologize for not getting into this a little earlier, but thanks for the call, Chris, so much. And Emily Gindelsberger, thanks so much for sharing your book with us. It's called On the Clock. Look it up if you want to read more about her experience at Amazon, Convergys, and McDonald's. And Jeff Earlywine, who came in from Boone County today, the administrator out there, thank you so much for adding to this conversation as well.
Thanks for having me.
And up next, we talk about how a basketball court is bringing together teens from different faiths. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. And you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Subscribe to our podcast at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks.